This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. America is so deep in debt that it's hard to wrap your mind around it. In fact, the current number has so many digits, it's hard to read. According to the Treasury Department's website, as of yesterday, the total U.S. debt is $7,786,439,534,447.57. We invited two economists to talk about how we got into this predicament, what the consequences might be, and how we might dig ourselves out. Brian Riedel is a fellow in budgetary affairs at the Heritage Foundation, a think tank with the self-described mission of formulating and promoting conservative public policies. Isabel Sawhill is director of economic studies at the Brookings Institution, a think tank which describes itself as centrist and nonpartisan. Riedel and Sawhill disagree on many things, but one thing they agree on is this. Although the debt might not be a huge problem in the short term, in the long term, it is. Isabel Sawhill says, here's one reason why you should be worried and why the problem is just going to get worse.
I think that the public needs to understand how large interest on the debt is and what proportion of their taxes are going just to pay interest on the debt. We did an estimate last year in our Brookings book called Restoring Fiscal Sanity, How to Balance the Budget, that showed that by 2014, interest on the debt alone would absorb all revenues that corporations pay to the federal government, or to put it a little bit differently, they will absorb more than one out of every five personal income tax dollars that the American public pays. So one of the big costs of not doing something about these deficits is that an increasing proportion of people's taxes, which they don't like to pay, none of us likes to pay taxes, is going to go just to pay that interest on the debt. So this becomes a huge problem out in 2040 or 2050, to be sure, but it becomes a problem well before then as well.
Brian Riedel, how do you deal with this paradox? And here's what I mean. You support major tax cuts. Okay, so in part because of major tax cuts, we're developing this huge debt, which means that the tax money that we will spend in the future will go to paying off the tax debt as opposed to funding social programs, roads, all the things we look to government to fund.
The Heritage Foundation supports specific tax cuts that can be proven to increase incentives to work, save, and invest, and be productive, which in turn will grow the economy. Raising taxes, by contrast, will often hurt the economy and reduce economic growth, which over the next few decades will produce less tax revenue and make the U.S. economy less competitive. The real crunch over the next few decades is on the spending side of the ledger. Right now, government spending on the federal level is about 19% of GDP. We estimate that by about 2040 or 2050, not including interest, it'll be about 28% of GDP. And when you add interest, it could be double of that. The spending area is the problem. We could raise taxes more than we've ever raised them in peacetime in American history, and it still wouldn't be enough to absorb the rising costs in Social Security and Medicare.
Do you agree with that, Isabel Sawhill?
I agree that on the trajectory we're on right now, that spending as a proportion of GDP is going to increase by something like 10 percentage points. In other words, it really is going to balloon out into the future. That's driven mainly by rising healthcare cost inflation, as well as the aging of the population that Brian referred to earlier. I don't agree that we don't need to raise taxes. It is true that if you raise taxes and just spent the money foolishly, it might have an adverse impact on economic growth. But if you raise taxes for the purpose of reducing deficits, that should actually help economic growth, because deficits are a form of borrowing that eventually push up interest rates or require that we become overly indebted to foreigners. So that's not good for economic growth either.
Can you explain what you mean about how deficits push up borrowing and leave us indebted to foreign countries. Give us an example of how that's working right now.
Last year, according to the Congressional Budget Office, foreigners, meaning other countries, both privately and publicly, lent us enough money to approximately cover our entire deficit in the federal budget. So in that sense, we're becoming extremely dependent on other countries being willing to lend us the money that we need to cover our deficit. We have two deficits. We have a deficit in our federal budget. We also have a deficit in trade with other countries. In other words, we are consuming more than we're producing, and we're making up the difference by importing goods from other countries. So they have to lend to us for that reason as well.
Brian Riedel, do you think our indebtedness to other countries is a problem?
At this level, our indebtedness to other countries is not yet a major problem, but as it continues over the decades, it can start to have a more detrimental effect on our GDP as we have to import more goods, and in general on our economy. Right now, one of the advantages, however, of other countries holding on to our debt is that our deficit isn't raising interest rates as much. Because if we don't have to borrow the money out of America's own investment pool, if we can borrow the money from other countries, then you don't see a huge demand pushing up domestic interest rates, which would have a detrimental effect. So right now, in a way, the country is benefiting from having foreigners buy our debt because it's keeping interest low. However, this can't go on forever, obviously, without having detrimental global effects.
Some economists have predicted an economic meltdown as a result of this deficit, projecting that we might face the kind of meltdown and rioting in the streets that happened in Argentina a few years ago. Do either of you think that that's a realistic projection?
If current trends continue into the next 3 to 4 decades, the United States projects into an economic and financial collapse on the scale that Argentina experienced. I'm confident that at some point policymakers will make some of the difficult decisions in order to avert this kind of catastrophe. This catastrophe relates only to if lawmakers do absolutely nothing over the next 30 years. I don't have a lot of faith in Congress, but I have some faith that whether it's a good solution or a bad solution, they'll attempt to address it somehow before something like that can happen.
I think a financial crisis at the level of an Argentina is possible, but quite unlikely. And the reason is because we have a very large and strong economy. We have deep and broad financial markets. Financial markets have changed a lot in recent decades globally. International capital is very fluid. So I think it's possible that, and in fact likely, that whatever the damage, we won't have a full-blown crisis. However, it's a risk. It could happen. And we should take action to prevent that risk, because if it did happen, it would be disastrous, not only for the U.S., but for the world economy as well. Right now, the United States is basically the engine of growth in the world. And as the engine of growth, if we have a big economic meltdown at home, the world is going to follow us down the economic path to recession.
My guests are Isabel Sawhill, Director of Economic Studies at the Brookings Institution, and Brian Riedel, a fellow in budgetary affairs at the Heritage Foundation. We'll talk more about the federal debt after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the federal deficit and how we got here and what we need to do to get out of the problem. My guests are Brian Riedel. He's a fellow in budgetary affairs at the Heritage Foundation, and Isabel Sawhill. She's the director of economic studies at the Brookings Institution. I want to ask you both, before we get any further about how to fix the deficit, how we got here in the first place. Could you each give your point of view about what got us in the fix? What is responsible for this huge deficit? President Clinton and Vice President Gore left us with a surplus. How did we end up with this deficit?
It has been a phenomenal turnaround from the large surpluses that were projected about 5 years ago and the huge deficits that we face now. There have been a number of factors that led to that turnaround. One is the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. Another is the recession that we had in the early part of this decade. A third is other spending increases, such as the major increase in Medicare spending that was put in place last year or 2 years ago, involving prescription drugs, and a number of other increased spending actions that Congress has taken. But having said all of that, I think the largest element in this picture has been the tax cuts that were introduced in 2001 and have continued since then.
Brian Riedel, how does that compare to your analysis of what caused the deficit?
From 2000 through 2004, we went from a $236 billion surplus to a $414 billion deficit. That is a $650 billion deterioration in our net fiscal position. Our analysis at the Heritage Foundation shows that the recession, in our opinion, was the single main cause for the deterioration because it both reduced tax revenues and increased costs for entitlement programs. Second, you've had a 33% increase in the cost of government over that time, less than half of which had anything to do with 9/11 and defense. Much of the rest of the increase was for spending increases across the board. And then the third cause of the deficit was the tax cuts, which has increased the deficit to a degree, although not as much, I believe, as some critics would suggest, because it probably made the recession slightly less severe and may well be contributing to the surge in tax revenues we're seeing now, as it may be helping increase incentives to work, save, and invest and help the economy. That doesn't mean that the tax cuts have overall increased revenue, but it means that the loss of revenue hasn't been as great as some feared.
Brian Riedel, would you say you're philosophically opposed to taxes and that philosophically you would like to see tax cuts, period?
The Heritage Foundation supports a limited government that assesses the minimum taxes necessary to carry out a limited amount of functions well. Increasing taxes places a difficult burden on families, it discourages economic growth, and unfortunately, it gives politicians more money to spend. And I have less faith in tax increases because I've seen over the years that members of Congress who often raise taxes with the best of intentions end up squandering the new revenue on wasteful programs rather than using the money most effectively.
Brian Riedel, just to sum up, to what extent do you think that the tax cuts affected the size of the deficit that we have now? How much are tax cuts the culprit here?
The tax cuts have increased the deficit, but because they have helped economic growth, they have not played a large role in the increase in the deficit, especially as not as large of a role as the recession and the massive increases in spending we've seen since 2001.
Well, I think we've hit here on a very fundamental difference in your points of view in terms of taxes, both the role that tax cuts have played in the creation of the deficit and the role that tax increases should play in dealing with the problem. Isabel, what do you have to say to what Brian Riedel just said?
Brian is right that the recession in the 2001 period in particular had quite a large impact, and that it was a good thing that we reduced taxes during that period. But my view is that those tax cuts should have been temporary, not as permanent as they have been and as the administration is now arguing they should be. If you look out into the future deficits that we've both been talking about, as opposed to the deficits that we had back in, say, 2002 or 3, then I think it's very clear that the tax cuts are the single most important source of those future deficits as opposed to our past deficits. So you can't sort of say how important have the tax cuts been without talking about which deficits you're talking about. As I said before, I think it's going to be very necessary to raise taxes as well as cut spending to eliminate the deficit. If you tried to do it on the spending side alone, it would require such draconian cuts that you would basically be eliminating many functions of government. And it is not politically realistic to think that we could get there. It would require spending cuts, for example, on the order of $600 billion a year, just to pick a figure. Those are cuts of about 10% or more.
So what programs do you think would be slated in these draconian cuts that you project?
Well, you would have to eliminate things like housing programs, training programs, education, the environment, criminal justice, many, many functions of government. And if you did that, I think there would be a political outcry of a sort you haven't seen before. And I think the current administration and the current Congress would be turned out of office very quickly. So that's why they're not doing it. There's been a lot of talk about spending cuts recently, but there's been no action or very little action on that front. The congressional budget resolution this year actually makes the deficit worse, not better.
Brian Riedel, Isabel Sawhill isn't projecting that we cut pork in order to get us out of the deficit. She's saying that if we don't raise taxes, we're going to be cutting the government's role in the environment, criminal justice, education. What do you have to say to that?
Bell is correct that it is politically infeasible to balance the budget in the next couple years on spending cuts alone. It would require approximately, as Bell says, about $600 billion in spending cuts out of a $2.4 trillion budget, about 25% of all federal spending. That's politically infeasible. However, the better solution would be, in my opinion, to reduce spending slowly over the course of a longer period of time, allow tax revenues to grow as the economy grow, and attempt to move to a balanced budget, not tomorrow, not by 2006 or 2007, but slowly and gradually over the next 10 to 15 years, as Social Security and Medicare are reformed, as wasteful spending is reduced, and as tax relief allows the economy to create wealth. That would be, I think, more stable than if we came out and tried to cut $500 or $600 billion out of the budget tomorrow, because Bell's right, that's obviously not going to happen.
I have a question for both of you. Do you think, you know, Americans have to make a lot of hard choices, obviously, about what they want their government to do, what services they want the government to provide, and what they're willing to do in order to face down the deficit. How do you think the question should be posed to Americans when they think about tax cuts and the future of the amount of taxes that they pay? What larger context do you think that should be put in when politicians talk about taxes and offer that choice?
I think it's quite simple. I think people need to understand that either they're going to have to pay much higher taxes or they're going to have to do with less help from the government in their old age, particularly the elderly who are comfortably well off or more affluent are going to have to pay more for their own retirement and their own health care. If they don't do that, then the working age population, which mostly means their own children, are going to have to pay much higher taxes. Those are the choices, and I don't think anyone is facing up to those choices right now.
What Congress won't tell their constituents is that as a result of the policies enacted both in the 1930s, the 1960s, and even most recently with the Medicare drug benefit, that taxes are going to need to be raised by about $10,000 to $15,000 per household in order to keep the level of government benefits that people are expecting over the next couple decades. the citizens have a choice. They can either accept permanent $10,000 to $15,000 per household tax increases, or they can come back and address what has become the geriatric state. Government has evolved from a welfare state that generally, you know, attempts to give benefits to the poorest in society to a geriatric state that generally exists to transfer money from the working to the elderly at a much higher cost than Americans are used to. And so it's a simple choice for taxpayers. Do we want to reform the programs for the elderly, or do we want to raise taxes to the levels we've never seen in peacetime?
Brian Riedel is a fellow in budgetary affairs at the Heritage Foundation. Isabel Sawhill is director of economic studies at the Brookings Institution. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our conversation on the federal debt. My guests are Isabel Sawhill, director of economic studies at the Brookings Institution, a think tank that describes itself as centrist and nonpartisan, and Brian Riedel, a fellow in budgetary affairs at the Heritage Foundation, a think tank with the self-described mission of formulating and promoting conservative public policies. Now, I know that there are many critics of the Bush administration tax cuts who say one of the things that got us into the deficits were the tax cuts, and particularly the tax cuts that are benefiting the wealthy. For example, tax cuts on capital gains and tax cuts on the inheritance tax. And there are critics of the Bush administration who would like to readjust those tax cuts. What do you both think? I mean, the argument here goes, And I'm sure you've heard President Clinton talk about this. He's saying that he's gotten this big tax cut, and that's one of the reasons why America is suffering, because people like him who are wealthy are getting, you know, tax cuts, and look what it's doing to the country. So what's your reaction to that argument?
Many of the tax cuts, which are the most maligned, the reducing of the top rate and the cuts in capital gains and dividends taxes, are the very tax cuts that are best encouraging working, saving, and investing, and helping the economy grow. Since the capital gains and dividends tax cuts, the stock market has grown, I believe, by approximately 20%. A lot of the individuals who we look at as the top 1% are actually small businesses. They don't pay the corporate income tax, they pay the individual income tax. So we're seeing a lot of small businesses reinvesting money into the economy, working, saving, investing in ways that's creating the economic growth. Keep in mind, this year, the IRS is reporting that tax revenues are coming in way above schedule, at a pace well above last year, well above projected numbers, because productivity increases have followed these tax cuts. So there is a positive effect on the economy. It's also important to note that since the president has taken office and enacted his tax cuts, the percent of income taxes paid by the top 1% has actually increased. Now, why is that? Two reasons. First off, because the president's tax cuts included lowering the bottom rate from 15 to 10%, getting rid of the marriage penalty and adding to the child tax credit, which helped the poor a lot. Also, although the president reduced tax rates on the rich, incomes have increased fast enough that a lot of the rich are actually paying more money in taxes now than they were before because their incomes have increased. As a result, the Bush tax cuts have actually made the income tax code slightly more progressive in terms of the percent of taxes paid by what income rank. So I think we're seeing the economy doing well. We're seeing tax revenues come in at a fast rate. The economy is growing. And while it's easy to just say we shouldn't give tax cuts to businesses and we shouldn't give tax cuts to rich people and we should only give rebates to low-income families, these are the tax cuts that are right now helping the economy grow.
Isabel Sawhill, agree?
This is an area where Brian and I probably disagree the most. I think that the tax cuts have been heavily tilted to the very wealthy, and that there is no offsetting gains from that of the sort that he has described, or very little offsetting gain, and that it's quite amazing the extent to which people have accepted the fact that we are now cutting programs for low-income families, asking people to sacrifice in all kinds of ways so that we can afford these tax cuts that have overwhelmingly gone to those who are already doing extremely well.
So I'm interested in this disagreement between you, which is representative of a larger disagreement in our country now about tax policy. Brian Riedel, you're saying the tax cuts, they've really helped the economy grow. And Isabel Soyhill, you're saying, no, the tax cuts are helping the deficit grow, and they're hurting the poor, and they're helping the wealthy. So is this like a philosophical or an empirical difference? I mean, you're seeing the same data, and you're interpreting it differently, or what? Like, what accounts for the difference between your points of view and for this larger dispute in our country?
Some of it probably is philosophical. I mean, we all have different views of what's the right or fair distribution of income in our society. My own view is that the distribution of income in the United States is highly unequal, has been becoming more unequal over time, does not compare well to other advanced countries, and that given the fact that we're a strong and wealthy country, we could afford to do more for ordinary middle class and working families who are struggling hard to raise their families and make ends meet, in my view.
On the issue of how President Bush's budgets have treated lower income families, I think it's important to note that the president's spending spree over the last 4 years has not excluded low income families. From 2001 through 2005, anti-poverty spending increased by 42%. That's an average of 9.2% a year, which is much faster than the 5.5% annual average growth in anti-poverty programs under President Clinton. Medicaid is up 46%, food and nutrition programs are up 56%, housing is up, the EITC is up, the child tax credit has increased through the roof, including its refundable portion. Spending on low-income families by President Bush has actually gone up faster than under President Clinton. I think it's also important to make two other points. First, that one way to help low-income families is by helping the economy. When the economy is in a recession, when people aren't working, low-income families are often hit pretty hard. If we could help the economy grow, I think we can help families. And on income inequality, you know, overall, one wonderful thing we've seen in the numbers on incomes is the mobility of incomes. Well, when we talk about the top 20% or the bottom 20% over the years, people assume that we're talking about the same people. In reality, people move up and down from, you know, people start out young, near the bottom. As they age, they move up. But over lifetimes, there isn't as much inequality if you account for movement between different income quintiles from year to year.
Isabel Soyhill?
Well, again, we could get into a debate about data here, which I think wouldn't work very well. But I don't agree that this administration has been friendly to the poor or to lower income families. In fact, the refundable tax credit that has helped those families that Brian just alluded to was not something that the administration proposed. It was something that I and a colleague at Brookings proposed and that Olympia Snow insisted be put into the 2001 tax cut bill so that those families would get a little bit of help. But overall, those families are not doing well. They do get Medicaid, and they do get the Earned Income Tax Credit and food stamps, and all of that is helpful. But they are still earning less per year or getting less total income per year than the wealthy are getting in tax cuts alone. And so we could have used those resources in ways that I think would have had a much fairer and broader impact on the American public. And I think that the other thing to worry about is that as income and wealth become increasingly concentrated in this country, people at the top are going to begin to have too much influence, including too much influence on the political system.
I want to thank both of you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Isabel Sawhill is Director of Economic Studies at the Brookings Institution. Brian Riedel is a Fellow in Budgetary Affairs at the Heritage Foundation.